Roger Hennessy. I was staff inspector for history, working to the Department of Education and Science.
Please, can you tell me about your early career in teaching and how you came to be an inspector?
Well, I had taught at the Royal Grammar School, Newcastle on Tyne. I was head of the economics department there, though I had a degree in history. I did some tutoring at Newcastle University in economics education. And I came to be an inspector because, casting around for a career move, I saw an advertisement for HM inspectors, and they wanted someone who was an historian but could also work in the field of political science and economics, which is precisely what I'd been doing. So I applied and was interviewed and appointed.
What date was that around?
Well, I took up post on the 1st of September 1973. So the process of interviewing, etc., was probably the early part of 73, yeah.
To what extent were your views about history teaching developing at that time? Were they influenced by curriculum innovation in school history in the 60s and 70s?
Well, I had to be on a steep learning curve when I became an inspector because I had been teaching economics and economic history, and I was away from the mainstream of innovation and development. So I had to learn a lot quickly. And it was the time when the so-called new history was very fashionable and popular. So I studied what it claimed to be doing and what it perceived as the enemy, and became and remained rather sceptical about some of its claims, although I could see it also had considerable attractions and strengths as well. But I was never converted to it, I couldn't say.
What do you mean by converted to it?
Well, I think a large number of people became uncritical about history, which the extreme case would be people who said, and I heard them saying it, history is essentially skills and the knowledge and content don't matter. That was the extreme wing, I suppose, of the new historians. What I liked about it was the idea that pupils were taught history in a sense is negotiable and there's more than one point of view. But what I didn't like about it were the simplistic and rather naive views it had about the nature of historical knowledge, which it usually characterised as being force-feeding facts and regurgitating them in simple tests. And of course there's a good deal more to history than that. And also, it seemed to be more interested in producing young historians than producing well-rounded, well-educated citizens, and I was a bit worried about that because school history's task is not to produce historians, as I saw it anyway. So that concerned me somewhat. As a result, it also not only, I think, made a caricature of what historical knowledge was about, it gave itself an excuse for not discussing what is, to me, one of the most controversial and difficult areas. What fields of history should you study and what should young people know, as well as what should they be able to do by the age of whatever, 7, 11 or 16.
What conclusions did you draw when, as an inspector, about the state of school history in the late 70s and then the early 80s?
Well, I was the chief statistician, so as to speak, of our history committee. So one of my jobs was to find out what kind of history was being taught and to how many pupils and what proportions of pupils at that time you mention. Starting with primary schools, we had pretty well come to the conclusion by the early to mid-80s that history was in very serious confusion there. In many schools it wasn't taught at all as such. It was an element in topics, that was the favourite word which they did. And these didn't seem to follow any rational and progressive pattern, that's to say getting intellectually more demanding from 5 to 11, apart from the language and some of the concepts involved. In secondary schools, we knew that the main strength was from 11 years old to 13 years old, where it tended to be on the core curriculum. But again, what did you mean by history? It was usually starting with early, I say Britain, really early England. They've therefore repeated a lot of what they had already done in topics in primary schools. We came across examples of people who'd studied the Vikings or the Anglo-Saxons three times running, if they'd been in a first, middle and secondary school, for example. But most of it tended to be a chronological survey, and it tended to run out because of the lack of time with the Civil War, or perhaps the early 18th century, and occasionally the Industrial Revolution, but rarely got beyond that. And then in the fourth and fifth forms, where history became an option, we found the most popular was modern British history, so-called, then economic and social history, and then a miscellanea with Tudors and Stuarts, probably the most popular element there. And then there's A-level and sixth form work. And there we found the curriculum, or the history syllabus, had more or less gelled as it was at the beginning of A-level in the early 1950s. There had not been very much development since. And some of us, not all, but some felt that it was insufficiently demanding intellectually, in the sense that although there was a lot to learn and a lot to say in examinations or write, there wasn't nearly enough historiography in it, and history was not regarded as a negotiable area of human discussion and endeavour, as opposed, for example, to sociology, where the self-same pupils would be quite capable of telling you the difference between a functionalist and a structuralist and a Marxist view of a particular incident or set of arrangements. But this was not done in history. So it was a tough exam, there's no question about that, but really rather narrow. So I hope that answers your question.
I wanted to ask you just about the syllabuses. You referred to modern British history. By that you mean 19th and early 20th century political history?
Yes, at its, I suppose, extremes, was about 1900 to about 1950. But most of it was the Great War, the interwar period, and usually a little bit beyond, but not much further. Yeah.
Now, were the schools doing world affairs or
yes,
world history? Yes,
they were indeed, and some doing very modern world affairs indeed. But they were a minority, but it certainly did occur, yes.
What was your view of John Slater's approach, as exemplified by the publication of History in the Primary and Secondary Years in 1985?
Well, I should say that I did subscribe towards it. I was one of the team that wrote it under his leadership. It represented, first of all, a statement about primary schools, which I supported entirely, because, as I said, it was in a very weak position, the subject in primary schools. I would have said John Slater's approach is really the apotheosis of that period of many syllabuses, many approaches. What I think we were trying to do under his leadership was to say what are the essential and irreducible elements of history, but then to produce a range of syllabuses which would bring this about. We also added, I mean, you look at it, it's very much a document of its time. We felt we should say something about history and gender, equal opportunities, history and ethnic minorities. These had become big issues at the time. And a minor obsession of mine, I'd put in history and mathematics. A small team of us got to work on this because we thought history was a subject which would develop a wide range of skills. At first, it wasn't easy to understand history unless you had some statistical basis about the size of populations, the movement of prices, the size of armies, whatever it might be. But also it was a way of developing number skills, as they were called, mathematical skills. And the same would go for language. History is as a developer of subtlety and nuances in writing and speaking. And there were schools, indeed, we knew, One I recall on Humberside, which actually had an examination in oral history, not in the sense of interviewing people like this, but standing up and talking about past events or developments, and developing as a result, the teacher hoped, and I think quite rightly, and succeeded, confidence in speaking and addressing and marshalling facts in an oral rather than written form. So all of that comes into John Slater's approach, as you call it, but the world was moving, I think, increasingly into a world of interventionism in education, and the idea you could just simply leave it to schools to create syllabuses, however worthy that might be, was going increasingly and was already starting to run into opposition then.
Were you actually convinced then, at the time that document was published, that in fact it couldn't result in a more rational and coherent curriculum across all schools? Was it just...
Well, I wouldn't say couldn't. Obviously it would be possible that it might, but I think it was rather unlikely. Since examinations determine a great deal of what goes on in schools, whether it's O-level or SATs or whatever else it might be, or even the teacher's own test. But external examinations play a very considerable part in this. And they would determine a lot of what happened in schools. So however clever and original and creative the ideas of schools might be, they had to square to what external examinations wanted. And there was no sign, as far as I could see, of O-level CSE, or as it became GCSE, changing radically to encourage a different kind of history in schools.
By a different kind of history?
Well, some of the suggestions made in history in the primary and secondary years.
So a broader approach to history with different focal points other than political history, is that what you are getting at there?
Yes, both for secondary 11 to 13, for O-level and for A-level, the great question of breadth was undoubtedly, it exercised us considerably. We suggested in this book, as I did later on, I think you're coming to that, History 5 to 16, ways in which it could and ought to be broadened. But frankly, unless you could get O-level and A-level to broaden, and the drop-down effect from those changes, it would be unlikely to happen in schools. Now, to take one example, in A-level, we frequently put this to the examination boards, that their history was a very narrow form, and their answer traditionally was, but we have a question last year on Darwin, or we had a question last year on Newton. And of course it's absurd to expect that the off chance of one question on Darwin or Newton or Faraday or something is going to cause an entire history course to broaden. It had to be much more systematic than that, and much more carefully thought through and resourced, and there are implications for teacher training as well. So John Slater's approach is, in a sense, a supply-side view of history in schools. It didn't really grapple with the demand side, and then, of course, think through all the necessary tactics and administrative changes that would be necessary. But it was a good statement of the time as to how you could broaden school history, other things being equal, but they weren't.
When you say the demand side, are you including demands from schools and teachers, which you as inspectors picked up when you went round?
Yes, there's a large number of demands, I suppose, on school history. There's the pupils and the parents, I suppose, yes. What public opinion broadly through the newspapers wants, and they're never short of strong views on school history when it arises as a subject, and of course the examination boards, who in a sense are the sharp end of the demand side, whether or not they're responsible to or responsive to the other groups, they do have or did have a great deal of say in what went on actually in schools. So unless you can get them to broaden the meaning of school history and give teachers time to think and prepare about it, it's unlikely changes will come about.
Of course, the Schools History Project had already negotiated a different type of exam for
That's
its
right,
syllabus.
Yes. Mm.
So was that seen as a precursor of potential change in other areas?
In one way it was broad because it did introduce you to the idea of history as negotiable truth. There was medical history in it, as you know, medicine through the ages, for example, which certainly didn't appear in many of the traditional history syllabuses. The weakness, as I saw it, was that it was not really the preparation for understanding, or one hopes, understanding the main issues of the modern world today, in the way the History Working Group did try to do. Because it invested so much time in the nature of history and historiography and the nature of evidence and how to assess it, it necessarily, I suppose, had to let fall by the wayside the chronological approach to history, which was traditional and had very great strength in it. If only someone could have, in a sense, produced a synthesis of what it stood for with modern or economic and social history courses, I think we might have made some very real progress.
But you didn't feel that GCSE did offer that compromise?
I don't think so. I mean, the school's history project was another syllabus. It didn't, it didn't infuse, I don't say infect, but it didn't infuse the other syllabuses, the modern Britain, for example, and economic and social history, to make them a little more conscious or considerably more conscious of the nature of history. Nor did it borrow from them their strength as chronological approaches to history. So it remained another history syllabus.
What were your priorities on appointment to the post of Senior Staff Inspector for History in 1988?
Well, obviously on a steep learning curve to learn the job quickly. I inherited a large number of papers from John Slater, which I read carefully. I'd been on his committee anyway. The main one, and I'm coming on to this later, I see, from your list of questions, was to get History 5 to 16 out of the doldrums, partly because the hierarchy of the Inspectorate and the Department of Education wanted it. They felt it was a very necessary document, and partly because it was in the doldrums, partly, I think, because the John Slater approach was, if not inimical, not sympathetic to the idea of a prescribed syllabus or curriculum. As you see from what I've said, it was to let 10,000 blossoms flourish, not to select any one or half dozen of them. Partly because the people involved in writing it were unhappy with the idea, I think, of boiling down our collective suggestions and wisdom, such as it was, on school history. And it had simply arrived at a point where people were merely exchanging papers or not making very much progress. Now, I realised that the hierarchy wanted it. I thought it would be a very good thing to get it going, even if people disagree with it, because it would focus and concentrate what we stood for in the world of increasing intervention by the government in education. In other words, to say it before it was said for us.
So did it coincide with the Education Reform Act? Is that what you mean by the growing government intervention?
Yes. I mean, you could tell the zeitgeist, you know, the sort of spirit of the times was that the government was no longer leaving education as just another department. It clearly saw it as a key one in its policy and style. And I thought also, from what I've told you before, you will realise that there was a good deal of confusion around the place, in schools particularly, as to what exactly history ought to be in schools. We knew from work being done on primary schools, and the report was to come out after this, but before the History Working Group was set up, history and geography in primary schools, that it was in a pretty messy state there. And it would be very helpful if something authoritative was said about it, even if only if people disagree with it, but at least it would get the debate going. So what I did was to take the papers that existed, because a lot had been written already on History 5 to 16, fill it out what I thought was the best of it, add some ideas of my own, I sent it around, first of all, a small group of my colleagues to see what they thought about it and made adjustments, and then I submitted it to the whole history committee, and it met with surprisingly little objection. And final draft I put then up to the Secretary of State via my own hierarchy. I went to see the Secretary of State, who liked it, although that was Mr. Baker at the time. He was a bit concerned the lack of proper names in it, but I said, well, once you begin selecting names, people will say, well, if you've mentioned X, why don't you mention Y? And you can get a rather barren debate going. Whereas if you say people should know about the Industrial Revolution, or people ought to understand that history is negotiable, in the sense it depends on who you are, where you are, your ethnic group, your gender, whether you're 20th century or 17th century or whatever, it does have an influence. These are the most important things, not whether you mention Mr. Gladstone or George Washington. And he agreed eventually with that, perhaps reluctantly. So the paper came out, and I think it, on the whole, commanded a lot of support. I know that some people disliked it intensely, and the people who were the most intense dislikers were those who really didn't want history in schools as such, the people who believed in the so-called humanities movement, who wanted history and geography and social science merged. Some of these were people who were what I would call curriculum engineers, who thought by doing that you'd save a couple of periods a week. But others, I think more dangerously, were those who thought that you didn't need to know basic history or basic geography, that you could learn through concepts and topics and so forth. And my view, it may seem old-fashioned epistemology, is that history really is different from geography or physics or chemistry or mathematics, and they're all different from each other, and they need to be taught as such. The subject-based approach, if you like. So I was a bit worried about the humanities movement, and they quite rightly saw in this document a threat to themselves, I think.
When you spoke of the committee that you presented to, that was a committee of inspectors? Or
yes, it was. No, purely inspectors. It went by various names depending on what the most recent reform was. For most of my life, it was C10, Committee 10. And then after the big reforms, it became sub, i.e. subject 7. And it consisted of, I suppose, different layers. There were the inspectors who did a lot of inspecting history in schools and colleges and polytechnics and so forth, and who were historians, basically. Then there were other people who perhaps had a history degree or were interested in history and had something to contribute because, for example, they were, give you one example, a primary phase specialist who liked the idea of history in primary schools, knew a lot about it, and although not a professional historian, past or present, nevertheless had a great deal to offer. So that was another group. And then there was a mutable group who came and went, who were social scientists, for example, and again, very interesting and useful indeed, because they'd ask the most difficult questions, what do you mean by, or how do you know kind of questions, and would challenge us. It's always a danger if you get purely a committee of nothing but specialists, they talk jargon to each other. And so I was always keen to get in some outsiders also to ask difficult questions. I suppose in numbers, the core was about 7 to 9. The full committee, when it met on one occasion, went up to about 20, but that was only about once a year, when we pull in all sorts of people who are country members, so as to speak. But generally speaking, I relied on a team of about 9 people, something like that, primary and mainly secondary.
And the main authors had been inspectors as well.
Authors of, sorry, what?
5 to 16 of the papers that
Yes. Indeed, they came from the core. Although I showed it to others. I mean, I did show it to the draft, I should say. I showed it to primary specialists, for example, to see if it made sense to them, people who weren't particularly historians but knew a lot about the primary phase and how it was organised.
So at that time, when it was published, you were aware that there was going to be a national curriculum? because that had been foreshadowed.
Oh, yes. Yes, that was becoming quite clear by then, and I thought it was important to get a preemptive strike in. Yes.
What role did you play in the selection of members of the National Curriculum History Working Group in 1989?
Well, two roles, really. One was I was shown the list, the long list, and did I have anything to say about these people in terms of their strengths or otherwise? And the other was I was asked to put up some names myself, teachers, for example, or teacher trainers, who we thought had a good deal to contribute. So, yeah, there we are, the two approaches. Yes.
What were the criteria for selection of members?
Well, we wanted an academic historian or two, partly for the knowledge that they had, but also, of course, to give us credibility in higher education. We wanted to make sure that the phases, primary and secondary, were well represented. We wanted to make sure that teacher training, which is very important as a, well, was then, I don't know now, but as a source of curriculum development, that was there. We wanted, as far as we could, when I say we, I mean the HMIs and I think the civil servants I dealt with, wanted a fairly broad spectrum of opinion on without extremists being present. And indeed, we got that. I think there was a good stretch of opinion from one member who was a chairman of a Conservative county council to others who were fairly left liberals, I suppose. But there certainly weren't any hard-line reactionaries or communists or anything like that on the group.
What about the new history, which you weren't so sympathetic to?
Well, I was sceptical about it.
Yeah.
Sceptical. I saw its very considerable strength, if only they could have been, as I said, embodied in more rational structures as I saw them. Right, to answer your question, yes, the knowledge of the new history and what it stood for was a sine qua non, and certainly no one, as far as I know, selected for the group was known to be hostile to it. One or two members were certainly very sympathetic to the general principles for what it stood, but I don't think any of them were hardliners, no.
How would you characterise your role at meetings of the HWG?
Well, my title was observer. There was a slight difficulty because, although I certainly did observe, the group did come to depend upon me from quite early on. For the old phrase that the trade union banners had that we discussed earlier, knowledge is power. And the HMI team that I headed and for which I spoke had an immense amount of information about actually what went on in schools, primary and secondary, and in teacher training, and for that matter, in a lot of higher education as well. And clearly anyone with that information would be in a privileged position in the history working group. In a good year, for example, I would receive from the team that I just told you about probably something in the region of 400 to 500, what we used to call notes of visit. This was when you'd gone to inspect history in some institution, you wrote it up and sent it to the staff inspector, and I read every one that came in carefully and would often ask questions raised on them. In addition to that, there were full inspections of institutions, which would usually have a history paragraph of some kind in them, and there were surveys, which would perhaps of a theme across schools, and that would often produce some notes of visit as well. So I had a vast stock of data at my disposal with which to advise the group. And of course, it's a different kind and a different weight of information to other opinions, because I was actually saying what was going on in our schools and what was hopeful and what was threatening and disastrous. So you understand my role was, although meant to be observer, I could advise them on actually what was going on and what best practice was, what worst practice was and why. So I suppose I had, yes, a privileged position is the best way I can put it, but I certainly tried not to dominate conversations or debates, and often would, you know, sit quietly as they went on and produce the torpedo later on, yes.
as they produce the torpedo. Can you think of an example?
Well, to say it's not like that, you know, as the case may be. Well, I mean, one was with the PESC, politics, economics, social and cultural sort of thing. I mean, they were getting, I think, understandably and rightly, very excited by this. And writing it out, and I, you know, I had to point out, you do know that the whole, only three quarters of what you're talking about hardly appears in our schools, and that the implications in terms of resources and teacher training are enormous. So if you're going to put that in the report, you better say something about the need to tool up the system to deal with these very enlightened ideas, as the case may be. I mean, that would be just one minor example, I suppose, yes.
Bearing in mind some of the issues that you had identified prior to the national curriculum as being problematic in school history,
yes.
Was it some? Did you see the work with the group as a way of addressing those issues, for instance, the weaknesses of primary history and the problems
of
examinations?
I did indeed, and so did my team, which is more to the point. I mean, you know, I was in contact with them either individually or collectively when we met, or small groups of them up and down the country at regular intervals, and we saw this as, you know, a once-in-a-lifetime chance to try and put right the drift which I suppose had gone on in school history, if you want to be very historical about it, since the 1920s, but more so I think since the age of organisational reform when comprehensive schools came in the 1950s, and curriculum development started in a big way in the 1960s, and some things had gone right and some things had gone wrong, and this was a great chance. From my own point of view or own standpoint, certainly the history of science, technology, material matters, economics and so on was something I thought should infuse all history courses, and so indeed did my team. We thought also that because history gives off messages as to what is and is not significant in schools, that matters like gender and ethnicity really ought to be addressed by the history working group, and the group agreed with this, because if you leave these things out, they're regarded perhaps as not significant. If you put them in, they are controversial. So you've got to think very carefully about them. And this again was a chance to put right something which had been entering drift and confused debate outside, or not debate at all, which is even worse, perhaps. Yeah. Oh, and another one I should add was British history. Now, it so happened there were one or two Celts, and like me, half Celts, on the committee. But the Secretary of State was very anxious, and I think so too was the government in general, that people should learn British history, or some British history. It didn't have to necessarily dominate the syllabus. But I had to remind them very early on that, i.e. the political heads, that British meant British, not English. There is a difference. And if you mean British history, considerable questions are raised then about how the history of Scotland, Wales, England and Ireland relate. Now, it so happens, I don't know if things have changed, but at that time there was very little historiography which treated the archipelago as a whole. It tended to be from the standpoint of one of the jurisdictions within it. So that was a very considerable challenge to the group. What do you mean by British history, and how do you bring aboard, so as to speak, Scottish and Welsh and Irish history? And to that end, the working group not only studied the subject at great length, but visited Scotland and Ireland. We didn't have to visit Wales. It had its own history curriculum committee. And we had Gareth Elwyn-Jones as a member of our, as well as the Welsh curriculum group, and he was superb at keeping us well abreast of what was going on in Wales and making sure that the Welsh dimension, if you like to call it that, of British history was fully respected. So we did take that very seriously indeed, and I think we were quite revolutionary in so doing. It is simply something which had not been considered in all these great and somewhat arid debates about skills and content, as to what the nature of British history really was.
Do you think that's been resolved, or was resolved at the time?
I think it was resolved to the extent it could be by the History Working Group, but one knew that in practical terms, probably not. the question of teacher training, of retraining and resources is enormous if you're going to change historiography in that way. So I'm afraid what we forecast began to appear before I retired. I don't know what happened afterwards, obviously, but it tended to be when the Scots and the English clashed, rather than a more creative view of Scottish history and its contribution to British history. So, you know, it's Bannockburn rather than the Scottish Enlightenment, unfortunately. So we did make a serious attempt to broaden it, the meaning of British, but in the knowledge that it would be a very uphill struggle and would be against, you know, the shortage of time and the shortage of resources and so forth. Yeah.
Were the contentious issues the ones you expected?
Not really, I think. There are only two that come to mind that were really contentious. One was not contentious at all within the history working group, but it was highly contentious in the country as a whole. And that was the structure of the curriculum which we'd been given. If it had been left entirely to the group, I can't say this is counterfactual logic, but I imagine they would have come out with something like History 5 to 16 with age-related objectives, what 7-year-olds should know and do in the way of history, 11-year-olds, 16-year-olds. Unfortunately, or whatever, fate decreed otherwise, we were given this structure of attainment targets and programmes of study, a structure which did not grow out of any great national debates of any length. It was somewhat, it was wished upon the system by the Black Committee. It was very new to everybody, and exactly what it meant and how many levels and attainment targets and all the rest was highly problematic. The difficulty with history was that the group felt, just indeed as the government did, that it was important that there were some areas and fields and elements, if you like, facts of history that young people should know. The government was of the opinion, or the Secretary of State, and I suspect Number 10 as well, that history should be in the attainment targets, because these were the elements of the curriculum that were to be assessed. And they knew quite rightly that if you assess something, it's going to be taught. But here you have an interesting problem of historical philosophy. What are 10 levels of historical knowledge? And I immediately saw, as my colleagues did, the snags in this. If you meant a chronological foundation for history, which is what we wanted and I think most other people wanted, did this mean that level 2, for example, was the Battle of Hastings, in which case someone who couldn't proceed beyond the level 2, would they study the Battle of Hastings for 11 years? That was obviously absurd. What did you mean by 10 levels of knowing about the Battle of Hastings? Its date, and finally by level 10, the time of day it took place, the latitude and longitude of Senlac Hill. It became stupid, and so the group saw, I must admit I played some part in helping them to see, that this was impossible, and that the only way forward was to make sure that history was in the programmes of study, where we had considerable scope to lay down what should and shouldn't be known, and to give space to schools to select not only optional themes of history, as well as the core themes, which everybody ought to know. We gave them optional ones, and we even gave them study groups, study units that they could concoct themselves. For example, the local history of the school, or the local history of the community, or whatever else it might be. So it was a much more flexible way of doing it. It gave you a core that you ought to know, options that it would be a good idea if you knew some of them, and complete freedom for the other. But unfortunately, a mantra began to develop, as I say, I suspect from Number 10. History must have knowledge in the attainment targets. They didn't seem to understand that the structure simply didn't apply to history. It might possibly work with the natural sciences, I don't know, but it certainly wouldn't work with history. I had a long and hard argument with the head of branch, Jenny Bacon, about this. She was a woman of very great ability and historically trained herself, and eventually saw the problem. And after a long, hard argument and some raised voices, she said, "You're right," and went off down the corridor to see her boss, I suppose. And so it went on. I don't think we ever really resolved it. It was still coming back, even in the days of Kenneth Clark, although he himself saw the problem. And when I remember in a meeting with him, it was brought up again, he waved it away, saying, "You know, we've been through all that, I understand the problem." So in the end, the knowledge went into the programmes of study, as we'd suggested, and the attainment targets were all concerned with the skills and capacities and understanding of history. So that was one contentious, to use your word, factor which was wished upon us. The only internal disagreement I ever remember was whether or not the history of Islam and Islamic civilization should be a core unit or an optional one. To the extent I had any say in it, and I was just one opinion among a number there, I thought it should be a core unit because of the immense importance of Islam in world history and its fantastic achievements. But some people thought it was too contentious or whatever, and so in the end it became an optional unit. And there's a final one, which was after the group had really finished its work. I dug my heels in on crowns, parliaments and peoples. It was only contentious between me and the National Curriculum Council, NCC. They thought crown, parliament and people, and I said, well, until 1707 there were two crowns and two parliaments, and technically that is the correct phrase to use. And I think, just to keep me quiet, they left it in the plural. But I said, you know, sooner or later it would not surprise me if there were once again more than one parliament in Great Britain. And presto, the crystal ball was right. Within 5 years, actually, yes.
So you did have quite a lot of influence over the content of the history study units and programmes of study.
Only the influence of argument. I mean, this wasn't my opinion against anybody else's. The question about the study units and the programmes of study and the attainment targets, yes, I did have a very strong role in, because they depended upon me to make the arguments with the department and the politicians. And in fact, I think, you know, I'd really probably started it by saying very early on, we've got to grasp this nettle. It's a serious one, and it's going to cause a lot of problems later if we don't do it now. So that was the one where I suppose I had most to say. The British one was simply a reminder from me, and rapidly met sympathy and went further than I'd suggested, that it had to mean more than that. PESC, the politics, political, economic, social, cultural, whatever, may or may not have arisen from my advocacy that history really ought to be broader, much more than political history, kings, queens and battles and so on. Otherwise it's open to the charge of Henry Ford, it's bunk. But once you begin to broaden it, as Henry Ford himself did with his big museums, to mean how people lived and everyday life and what they were frightened of or wanted or whatever, yes, I had some influence there, I suppose.
Did the interest of the press or the arguments of academic historians, which were going on in outside the group, affect your work with HWG?
Well, in the sense, it was very, very considerable and very noisy from the press, and we certainly did take an interest in what they said, but I don't think it caused us to do things which otherwise we wouldn't have done, or the other way around. But we did take a very close interest in it. If anything, it strengthened some of the arguments we'd brought forward about the importance of historical knowledge or the breadth of British history or whatever. And of course also the fact that they read other reports and knew that history was weak in certain areas like primary school. So perhaps collectively the media did help. The arguments of academic historians, well, I suppose it depends which one. We called together at Chatham House a number of leading academic historians of the country, including Conrad Russell and Eric Hobsbawm, people like that. I gather what goes on at Chatham House is meant to be secret or something, but the fact is they were very supportive. Conrad Russell in particular had clearly read our reports very, very closely indeed and made some very pertinent and cogent points. We met at the Royal Historical Society a group of academics, including the Regius Professor of History from Cambridge, who liked the introduction to the report and said it would serve universities just as much as schools, explaining why history is important. Some may have misunderstood or weighed in. Because they saw there was some British history there, they would say that history is much broader than Britain. It shouldn't contain just British history. Well, it never did contain just British history. And I suspect that some of them had access to Grind and perhaps hadn't read. But broadly speaking, academia was very supportive of the work of the History Working Group. There were some who criticised in detail, rather than the entire argument, what we were putting forward. Some, indeed, I suppose, more of the right, who simply didn't like the idea of the skills of history being in the curriculum at all. They wanted it to be entirely to do with information. But of course, that raised the question then, how, apart from crude tests, right, wrong, do you assess an understanding of history? So on the whole, the press and academia were helpful, I would say. Or by no means uncritical. I mean, we certainly got plenty of criticism and letters to the editor and individuals criticising particular units. I mean, there's plenty of that went on. But the general structure did not come under any serious attack, as far as I recall.
What was your view of the final report produced by the HWG?
Well, since I had a lot to do with it, I suppose I ought to admire it. But to be quite frank, and now looking back over the time, and it wasn't the History Working Group's fault at all. I think it's probably too complex. Had it been something a good deal smaller, I'm again mentioning History 5 to 16, not because it's peculiarly excellent, but like the Code Napoleon, you can carry it around in your pocket sort of thing. And I think something which had been smaller and had left rather more initiative to the schools wouldn't have been bad. But of course, we lived in an age at that time of increasing formalisation and intervention in education, and all these levels that had to be spelt out and every programme of study. And it looked pretty formidable. I think when receiving the document, people probably blenched at the sheer detail and size of it. That would be the one criticism I would have, but it's not the fault, I emphasise again, of the group. They were given a peculiar structure with all these attainment targets and programmes of study, which simply didn't reflect the way in which most history had been taught, read, spoken about and understood over the ages, and certainly in our schools. And they very loyally rose to the occasion and delivered the government the structure it wanted. But it did make it very formidably complicated. That's the problem, as it seems to me. And of course, the other problem was that, in spite of rather general and vague indications to the amount of time available, I think it would have been helpful if the group had been given a very limited and conservative view of the amount of time they would have available for history courses. That would have, I think, caused them to produce perhaps a smaller document, or to say that this kind of syllabus could only be developed if schools had enough time, and that would involve whatever. So that was not of their... The flaws, in other words, are not of the group's making. It was very loyal to its remit, and within that produced a first-rate and very readable document, if you've got the time. Yes. Yeah, I don't mind. Yes, it's all right.
Can I ask you about your meetings with Kenneth Clark? Because a number of changes were made to the national curriculum afterwards.
Yes, indeed. At various levels, sometimes I would receive from the Department of Education a phone call or a minute saying the Secretary of State was concerned about the lack of this or the amount of that. And they were quite easy to adjust. One, I recall, was strengthening references to the Industrial Revolution, because Presumably he or his advisers thought more should be said about Britain as a manufacturing and trading power, which is perfectly fair and in keeping with generally what the HWG wanted. There were other occasions when I would meet the Secretary of State. One was the very contentious issue as to where history should stop, which may seem in philosophical terms a fatuous question, but in practical terms for schools, do you stop in 1900, 1939, 1950, or whenever with the course? Because at that time, history was going to be compulsory right up to the age of 16 when you left school. Now, various suggestions have been put to the Secretary of State. Broadly speaking, I would suggest the further right you were, the further back went the date. It was seriously suggested by some that 1900 would be a good end to the course, at the time when Britain was presumably a top imperial dog of the world. Others wanted it brought up because they wanted young people trained in civics and citizenship and political literacy, and they wanted it brought up much nearer to the present day. And I should just say in parenthesis that, among others, the Speaker of the House of Commons then was very anxious that young people should learn through school history how Parliament operated now and how the machinery of state was organised now, putting it in its historical context, of course. So there was a meeting at which this vexed question was discussed by, there was the Secretary of State, some ministers, some senior civil servants, a political advisor or two. And the consensus was moving towards 1939, and I up and spoke. I was sitting actually almost next to the Secretary of State and said, if this were the case, then you would not have the Second World War or Winston Churchill in the curriculum, and that would run into a lot of opposition and also give people a rather skewed view of history. And he agreed. So then we had to find a formula, and I suggested that history ended 20 years ago for practical purposes in school. So it would be moving all the time. At that time it would have been, I suppose, 20 years before 1991, and so it moves on and on. And Kenneth Clark thought that was an ingenious and practical suggestion, and that was where it was left at that time. I don't know, say, what happened since. And then finally, after that, there was another fraught meeting, because people had realised late in the day that the curriculum was becoming overcrowded, because instead of there being a proper curriculum divided into subjects and times, every subject working group had got the bit between its teeth and demanded the maximum it possibly could for its field. And it was getting very congested, particularly in Key Stage 4, the 15, 16-year-olds. And at that meeting, I was just really sitting in on it and saying what was going on in schools and what might. It was decided to make history optional. Certainly not my decision, and advised against it, because as soon as it becomes optional, it means quite possibly half or more pupils don't take it. It means that all the work of the history working group would not go by the wayside, but it would just be another approach to school history. If it became optional, you could do history and humanities, you could mix it up and so forth. So there, alas, I didn't manage to persuade the meeting at all. And again, what happened subsequently, I can't say, because I had retired some 18 months, 2 years after that. So those are my meetings, yes, with the Secretary of State. I should say about the business of the moving date, there was a short period halfway through the group's existence when it had been suggested by an eminent academic to us that we could drop the Second World War and move on to the sort of formation of the modern world with the Third World, the Soviet Union, and it was weakening, of course. So young people came out of school understanding things as they are now, and he thought it was worth making a sacrifice of that kind, and the group was persuaded for a while. I went to see the chairman, Michael Saunders Watson, and said, this is a disaster, you better be careful. And he said, well, why? And I said, well, you're going to get, among others, the old soldiers, the British Legion, the Burma Star Association, not to mention the Jewish lobby, who will be on you, and the Daily Mail, because you simply can't leave out this huge shared experience, and you know, the November the 11th and all that sort of thing. And Saunders Watson came round and said, well, yes, you have a point. And it actually, it leaked out somehow, because there were questions in the House and everything got rather heated about it. But by then it didn't really matter, because the group had come back to thinking, yes, it would restore the Second World War onto the curriculum. But it was for a while heated and a matter of great excitement, and got into the press, which only goes to show that history is the most politicised of all the subjects.
I'm sure you were aware of that at the time when you were doing the curriculum.
That it was politicised?
Yes.
Oh, very much, yes, yes. I knew this all the time. Although, oddly enough, I had a feeling before it met that if you got a good team of good historians together, they would probably come to conclusions more readily than those who you thought ought to. For example, I believe, though I can't say authoritatively, there were furious arguments on the mathematics group about, I suppose, old and new mathematics, the use of computers and calculating machines as opposed to mental arithmetic and so on. So it rather went counter to what people had forecast. The history group had very few disagreements and was a very pleasant organisation, very industrious, but no, very few sort of raised voices, anything like that. Some other groups weren't so happy, but I won't go into the details.
Looking back over the past 20 years since the national curriculum has been implemented, did you feel it came at the right time and actually did change school history fundamentally?
Yes, I mean, it's sort of rather like Lenin's two steps forward, one step back. I think it came at the right time, because like History 5 to 16 and History in the Primary and Secondary Years, John Slater's document, it came at the right time because confusion was beginning and there was a kaleidoscope, a variety, and people wanted to know what the best buys were and what worked and what didn't, and was it true what was being said about this, that and t'other. So it came at the right time, I think, as a sort of synthesis or syncresis, perhaps, of trying to find the best and to say what it was. It did clear the air in that way and give people some kind of a lead or something to disagree with, if you like. But it also came at a time, of course, of huge national ferment in the curriculum, and it couldn't escape the problems of overcrowding and resourcing and teacher training and all the rest of it. But we, I think, knew that it was likely to shrink. We used to call it design it for perfect shrinkage, that it would probably have to shed in primary schools, that probably the 16 to 19 area wasn't what we liked. But I'll put it this way, I still think it was the best summary of its time. I still think it presents a very clear pattern which you would have to be very clever to argue round or out as to what school history, broadly speaking, should be about. So it remains, if you like, a council of perfection, but the system isn't perfect and hasn't risen to it. But let us hope one day it gradually will, although obviously, I mean, there will be changes of emphasis and fashion and so on, but broadly speaking, the kind of structure it had and the synthesis of skills and concepts and content and all that, carefully worked out, would remain a very good model, I think.
Thank you very much.
Right.